This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
This reminds me of, I think, the opening sequence in the film that you will see. Slavoj Žižek is giving a talk in an amphitheater, and with my bad Spanish, I understood that we have to go to a bigger room, and well, unhappily, we can't do this here. But what I can do first is introduce the speakers who are here tonight, and I'll start with Daniel Dayan, who is further left, who is director at the CNRS and professor of sociology at École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales in Paris. He's visiting this semester at Penn and has spoken very recently on public intellectuals, on publics and intellectuals. He's the author of many articles and several books, Media Events in English, The Life of Broadcasting of History, and in French, among many other things, Le Théâtre de la Terreur. Then next to him, Eduardo Calava, who teaches in English department at Princeton University, who has last presented at Slot with Gayatri Spivak on the politics of mourning. His many publications include Words of Light, Theses on the Photography of History, Who Comes After the Subject, and Justice for All, The Claims of Human Rights. And then next to me, Ann Norton, Alfred Cass Turnchair Professor of Political Science and Comparative Literature at the University of Pennsylvania. She has authored numerous books, chapters, articles on American popular culture and political theory. Her most recent books include Leo Strauss and the Politics of the American Empire and 95 Theses on Politics, Culture, and Method. So I'll just launch this conversation, and I can say that we haven't really prepared anything written, and we'd like to engage you as well by saying that I just checked recently the listing on the prospect in November 2005 for who are the public intellectuals, and I discovered that Slavoj Žižek figured, but he was only number 23rd, the first two being Noam Chomsky and Umberto Eco. But nevertheless, Slavoj Žižek was there, and just before him, Baudrillard, number 22nd. So this is why we thought, in order to prepare for what I think this very interesting documentary film shows, is who is a public intellectual? What is a public intellectual? Why can somebody like Slavoj Žižek, whose writings are not so easy to understand, can figure prominently in America, in the U.S. context, as a public intellectual, and whether he corresponds to our notions? And I think both Daniel, Diane, and I want perhaps to go back to something we know perhaps better, which is the European public intellectual. But somebody like Slavoj Žižek, who is an international public intellectual, is the figure that who interests us tonight. So I don't know who wants to continue from here, maybe? Yeah.
Yes, I think that I have the advantage for starting, the advantage of ignorance, is that I know really a number of little things about French intellectuals. So I think that what I'll try to do is to situate a little bit the way in which these problematics can be relevant to this debate. I think that one of the very interesting problems, I believe, that we have had in France for many years is that we have too many great intellectuals and perhaps not enough debate. And that I think that somehow the great intellectual is not always a blessing. And I think that I would like to stress somehow another distinction which seems to me quite important, which is that between the intellectual and the expert. I think that a number of people are somehow confined to the role of expertise. And for example, when Umberto Eco is defined as high on the list of intellectuals, I do believe he's something I immensely respect. But I'm not sure whether he would himself look for the toga or the crown of the intellectual, or whether he would not very, elegantly leave it to someone else. I think that in my personal history, it is important to know that I was born, I mean, given my age, at a time where when you think of a public intellectual, you think of the paradigmatic opposition between Jean-Paul Sartre and Raymond Aron. And Jean-Paul Sartre, who is somehow the prophetic intellectual, and I think this whole dimension of prophetic intellectual seems to me quite relevant, as opposed to Raymond Aron, who was a very lucid man, whose lucidity led him to make rational statements, moderate statements, and statements that were considered not only uninteresting politically, but also boring by some. And I think that what is very interesting is that in the French intellectual history, there has been this sort of enormous rehabilitation of Raymond Aron, who proved to be an extremely lucid individual, and who has opened perhaps one of the main avenues of intellectual performance. Raymond Aron was a philosopher, he was a sociologist, and he was a journalist. And it was quite important that he was a journalist. And I think that this is really one of my interests, has to do with, in France, whenever you want to kill someone, whenever you want to do character assassination, you say, oh, that guy is a media intellectual. As if you could be a public intellectual by, you know, going, you know, rushing after people and speaks, you know, murmuring in their ears. And how many people can you address? So, public intellectuals have to be in some way media intellectuals. And perhaps the gist of my participation to this discussion is to look a little bit at certain French media intellectuals and the way in which, it started, our history starts with two very famous figures that are Voltaire and Zola. And Voltaire, who's perfectly able to write very short, very lapidary texts. And I think that what interests me is that after a while, you have this sort of emergence of a number of people. I think that what strikes me is perhaps two facts. First, you have, it seems to me, in France, the most important intellectuals are often collective intellectuals, in that you have journals or reviews like Esprit or Critique or Les Temps Modernes or Le Débat, where you have this sort of interesting almost anonymity. I mean, it's not a real anonymity, but you have this sort of debate within which a number of intellectuals participate and produce some common statements. And it seems to me that those fields are very far away from the fetishization of a number of great figures. So this is one of the points I wanted to throw in the discussion. Second point is that it seems to me that a number of intellectuals have strategies through which they emulate certain figures of the art world. I think that, for example, people like Virilio or Baudrillard are very much discussing the art world, but they use the very same approaches that a number of artists used in order to reach what Bourdieu would call distinction. I think that concerning media intellectuals, I'm interested in the evolution of two figures, which I will sort of mention rapidly. One is Régis Debray, whom you know was a very famous at the time of Che Guevara, whose companion he was, since he went to South America and became a guerrillero and was in prison for a number of years. Régis Debray came back to France and created very interesting a journal called Les Cahiers de Médiologie. And he proposes to create some sort of a new discipline, which would be that of the media understood in a very general sense. So you have very clearly this concern. And then you have the curious dancing around the issue of media, which is offered by Pierre Bourdieu. Pierre Bourdieu has for a very long time, has kept this very austere conception of sociology, which is that if sociology doesn't reach some structural dimensions that are not really perceived by the actors, then it is blah, blah, blah. It is some sort of journalism, and he dismissed it very, using the high horses of science and presenting himself as the continuator of their time. But then at some point, Bourdieu became fascinated with television, and this happened when he did a show called Arrêt sur l'image. And when he did this show, he was given free reign. He was free to do whatever he wanted. And he did whatever he wanted, but what he wanted was very poorly adapted to the format of television. So whatever he wanted turned out to be a catastrophe. And Bourdieu spent a lot of time reflecting on this catastrophe, and then he wrote this book, La Télévision. And I think that it is very interesting to see how Bourdieu became, at one point, at the end of his life, he took himself away from all his austere predicaments concerning how distant sociology has to be vis-à-vis its subject to become very fully engaged in publishing. He became a publisher, he became a producer, and I think that it is interesting to see the sort of evolution of someone like Bourdieu. And I think that, on the other hand, you have a number of media people who seem to be promoted to the figure of public intellectuals. People who started as journalists and somehow moved from journalism to a position of grandeur. I mean, for example, Jean Daniel, the French journalist, he's the head of a very famous newspaper called the Nouvel Observateur, but he seems to believe that the fact of having signed checks for Michel Foucault turns him into Michel Foucault, which I'm not totally sure he is. Or Ignacio Ramonet, or Edith Plenel. You have all these figures of journalists that occupy the position of public intellectual. And finally, perhaps I'll stop here because I'm not supposed to give a lecture, or I'm hiding behind the lecture because I'm not good enough at discussion. So, but let me finish my point. I'm just finished. I'm very fascinated by the emergence of a new figure, which is the figure of the filmmaker as intellectual, as the filmmaker as public intellectual. This started, you had this sort of slight tremulation that started with the work of Jean-Luc Godard. But Jean-Luc Godard was always frequenting intellectuals and somehow reverberating their speech. I mean, Jean-Luc Godard listened to Althusser, and then he asked Anna Karina to repeat whatever Althusser had spoken to. But at some point, you have, it seems to me, two very important texts, or two very important films, that are really the moment where people take position through cinema. And I think these two important texts are one by Marcel Ophuls, Le Chagrin et la Pitié, where a French filmmaker decides to look back at the past history of France during collaborationism. And the second of these films is done by a famous intellectual, since he's the head of Les Temps Modernes, the journal of Jean-Paul Sartre, it's Claude Lanzmann. And the film is Shoah. And Shoah has a very specific way of provoking, it has a dramaturgy, which is a dramaturgy of confrontation. And this dramaturgy of confrontation is inscribed in every shot of the film. So you have here a very clear vision of the role of the intellectual as the one who disturbs. And I think that perhaps it is important to finish on this notion of disturbing intellectuals. I think that by these words, I think I'm returning to Sartre, who said that a public intellectual is someone who meddles in whatever doesn't concern him. Okay? I think that by this definition, you would define any concierge as an intellectual. So perhaps it needs a little bit more of a definition.
Thank you. Maybe to just rebound from this absolutely fascinating French view. What interested me in two moments in the film is when you see Žižek on American television, and you will see this journalist tries to say, this book is impossible to read. And Žižek immediately jumps in with a very funny story, you will see, and manages to convince him that what he writes is not too difficult, too abstract. And the other moment is when you see Slavoj Žižek looking at the Lacan still, Lacan giving a talk on television, and of course, as you may know, Žižek is always quoting Lacan, but there, he's totally critical of Lacan, saying, this is bad, this is not what one should do, and indeed, in his only single television broadcast, Lacan is very, very hard to follow. And so, Žižek, I think, has understood the need to take something like pure intellectuality and bring it to a certain level that can be translated or made concrete, exemplified. And this is what I was wondering, whether this was a more American situation, the need to be really down to earth, close to examples that everybody can
can identify with, follow, or not, and whether the French scene was more on a sort of higher level of intellectuality. At least that's what the question maybe for Anne. I don't know. Yes, but.
Well, that is it. You'll see it's actually a great moment in the film because, partly because Žižek does this very odd thing where he immediately recognizes the role that the American TV host is playing, which is, I am not an intellectual, and you are. And he both exaggerates his kind of self-presentation as an Eastern European intellectual who looks sort of like a kind of down at the heel Karl Marx. And he does. It really, I've never seen him before. And his physicality is really fascinating. He looks, he's a little bit doughy, and he's constantly looking off in this distracted way that reminds me of all the mathematicians I've ever known. And he does have this sort of very Marxist sort of, what do you say, physiognomy. And so that the way in which Žižek steps so readily into the role that's been prepared for him by the TV host is really rather charming. But it's very frustrating in relation to Lacan, because I actually thought the Lacan on TV was fabulous. And he says, oh, Lacan, he has all these silly gestures. And I'm going, so you don't have silly gestures? You wait and see. He has many silly gestures that are very effective. And whereas Lacan has a kind of formality, which is, and also he has French so good even I can understand it. It's really quite lovely. Žižek, as a public intellectual, he raises a couple of questions for me that I'll put out not on the table but on the floor for you. I mean, one is, why do we talk about public intellectuals? When you think about it, it ought to be something. I mean, why isn't it an intellectual of the people? Or a political intellectual. But these are somehow forbidden terms, I think. And instead we have this replacement, the public intellectual, which seems remarkably like, and you'll see why I've been going to this vein, because Žižek is so preoccupied with it. It's much more like a public facility. Or, I mean, he's preoccupied with toilets in this film. And there's a kind of sort of general availability to all visitors, and a sort of neutrality, and that the public intellectual, I think, is meant to do. And in the course of this, Žižek says something about politics. He says, my heart's not in it. And he insists upon his desire to be an Enlightenment figure, that he's really only interested in theory. And I have to say, I find this rather heartbreaking, because although, you all are free to, like, throw things at me for this, I actually think Žižek, really, as a theorist, man, stick with Lacan, but there's a sense in which Žižek's contribution, it seems to me, is really political. Because when Žižek, it seems to me, is really incisive, is when he gets off his one-liners. And he has a few in here, but although I love the film, it doesn't quite do them justice. So I'll give you two. And Žižek says, there are two problems with immigrants. They are lazy and they take your job. And you should all laugh at this because it's really hilarious. And it's very smart. And it's smart in a way which is quite characteristic of Žižek, that he recognizes this constitutive contradiction in the way that the immigrant is constructed in political discourse. And he's really enormously incisive about that. He just cuts like a knife. And he has another one that my partner reminded me last night. I may say she is a big Žižek fan, and she said, well, Žižek says America does have a working class. It's in China, and that is it's very funny and it's absolutely on point. It's an extraordinarily revelatory statement. And so why does he say, I don't like politics, my heart's not in it? I mean, his heart may not be in it, but his mouth certainly is. And he really is. He does, I think, some of his most theoretically sharp and elegant work when he does what appears to be a kind of stand-up comedy routine. And that unwillingness to sort of what do you say, to accept that project troubles me a little bit. In part because there are two people, well, he's critical of Lacan in the film, and he's also critical of Judy Butler and a little bit of Derrida. And he's critical of them in a rather interesting way. He's critical of them for being insufficiently accessible. Now, I'm not so sure that Zizek is actually much more accessible than they are. And there is one sense, I think, in which Zizek has something to answer for in relation to them. And that is that both Judy Butler and Derrida have taken very seriously the obligation of bearing witness. And Zizek is really not having any of it. And yet there is there is a sense in which that reluctance to assume a certain political responsibility, I think, is something for which he has to answer to Butler and Derrida, and in a curious way to Lacan as well. And so that's where I'll hand over to Edward, I think.
Okay. Well, actually, I'll just say a few things about some of the things that have already been said, and then I'll say some different things as well. I did like the comment that the filmmaker ought to be considered an intellectual, and I think that this is something that is perhaps more European than American, where very often in America you have a director rather than a filmmaker, and so they get the script from somebody else, whereas in Europe they write the scripts themselves, they're involved in the making of the film. Angonopoulos would be another filmmaker who's very theoretically inflected, archivally based, and very political in his films. So that's one thing. And it's linked to a couple of comments that both Jean-Michel and Anne made in relation to the scenes from the film. Because one of the things that I think one can say gets staged in the film is the fact that, at least for Zizek, it makes no sense for the intellectual, for the public intellectual, to be against TV, right? To be against journalism, to be against the media in general. You know, so that there's some significance there that in terms of, I mean, you suggested it too, that if one is going to be a public intellectual, one also has to be a media intellectual. But I do think that there are a lot of ways in which one can qualify or define that, and I'll try and get to that in a minute. But one of the things that I was thinking about is sort of just this question, a kind of broad question, on what is an intellectual, and what would it mean for an intellectual to write, think, teach, and speak, often, if not always, in public, publicly. And I would say that it's probably the case, and I know that some examples have already been given, but I think it's probably the case that today, more than ever, it's extremely difficult to provide a rigorous definition of the intellectual. And I think that at the same time, if one were going to do that, you would at least have to consider a series of things. And I think one is that you have to think about particular types of skills and knowledge that are associated, I mean, historically, institutionally, and so on, with the concept of the intellectual. And these are most often linked to the art or technique of speaking in public, right? I mean, in this context, which is also why I think that the plea or urgency with which some academics, for example, encourage other academics to become more public in their work is a bit misplaced, since in a certain sense teachers and scholars already do much of their work, at least in a certain segment of the public. So maybe it is a question of how far one goes in that. But one would have to pay attention to the particular set of skills and knowledge, I think. One would assume and maybe analyze a division between private and public events, where one would have a sense of what sort of configuration of spaces one would call public. So if somebody is speaking here, in a cafe, in a street, in a university setting, these are things that one would say, I think, one would talk about speaking in public in those contexts. So a division between the private and the public space, although, of course, we know that this difference is transforming itself more and more and more quickly. I also think that one would need to think about the division of labor that is assumed when one talks about intellectuals between intellectuals and non-intellectuals. Right? And I think that this is something that that division, I mean, you referred to Voltaire and earlier figures. I mean, I would probably say that that division, at least the way in which one uses the word intellectual in the sense that we use it, probably emerges in the early 19th century. But this is something that one can maybe talk about. I do think that if an intellectual is going to write and speak in public, that he or she ought to align themselves with those who are unable or don't have the right to speak and write in public. And I think that this is something that at least I would start in order to try and tweak and modify a more general notion of the intellectual. I'd start marking it in certain directions. But that's certainly one of the ways in which I would mark it. And I think that if one says that today more than ever it becomes more difficult to define, specify in a rigorous fashion what the intellectual does, I still think that those of us who think of ourselves as intellectuals, and I think a lot of people resist the word as well, ought to insist on the authority and rights and let's say publicity that one can have, especially as a means to go against a certain kind of anti-intellectualism, which seems more threatening than ever, I would say. I also think that this is also a way to put whatever little remaining bit of credit we have as intellectuals at the service of those, again, who don't have the right to speak or write in public, and also at the service of what is not thought. I mean, one of the things that you'll see in the film is that I think Žižek does portray himself as someone who is thinking what has not yet been thought. And I think that what has not yet been thought is always on the side of what has not yet been given voice. Right? So that I do think that the intellectual ought to be someone who is aligning himself with the gesture of trying to give voice to those who don't have a voice and to those things that have not yet been given a voice. This is why I think the media link is very important. The other thing, and this I'll just very, very quickly I'll say, I do think that the fact that intellectuals today have to write and act and take positions, make polemics, in the absence of clear answers to basic questions about their own position, legitimacy, authority, and prerogatives is the condition of intellectual work in the realm of popular politics today. I mean, that is the context within which we are working. And I will only then just, in order to talk about a kind of double bind that I think the intellectual finds himself in, and maybe to help specify that work, among a number of people who engage in these questions, one knows that a lot of authority is given to Gramsci, right, as someone who wrote on the formation of the intellectual, somebody who talks about the intellectual. And I think that especially among intellectuals who have populist propensities, one can talk about Cornel West, Edward Said, even further back, R.P. Blackmore in the States. These are people who, especially the first two, did go back to Gramsci as someone who helped them delineate the task of the intellectual. And I think that one thing that's worth remembering is that Gramsci's sense of the organic intellectual was not a populist. I mean, the organic intellectual was not a populist. And I think that is something that accounts for why so many intellectuals whom we might wish to call public intellectuals gain their force from their relation to a particular group, like Cornel West, Patricia Williams, Edward Said. I mean, they gain their force as representatives of a particular group, even though their claims often are made in the name of something more universal. And so just very quickly, I think that when Gramsci says, for example, that all men are intellectuals, he very quickly then says that not everyone functions as an intellectual in society. And so that he makes this distinction between traditional intellectuals and organic intellectuals, which I know a number of you already know. The traditional intellectual would include the clergy, the philosopher, the literary critic, the artist. And over against these clerics, Gramsci imagines a new class of the intellectual who would be different than these and who would be intimately associated with the life world of industrial workers. Right? So that there's a way in which the production of organic intellectuals is linked to an education and expertise that is based on an experience of the conditions of a particular class for which this intellectual is speaking. And that's why I was trying to say that at times it seems as if the force of the public intellectual often comes in relation to a particular group. I'll say two things, and then I think I'll try and close. I think this distinction between traditional and organic intellectuals is something that is completely fissured within Gramsci. And for him, the identity of intellectuals is always relational and dynamic, and that this opposition doesn't hold. But I think that to the extent that an intellectual gains his or her force in relation to particular claims and groups and so on, at the same time, there can be no intellectual work that doesn't evoke, and I think this comes out in the film, that doesn't evoke the values of the Enlightenment. And I think I'll say that in a particular way, even though we know that people like Adorno and critics like Adorno and Horkheimer also taught us to distrust the values of the Enlightenment. And I think that this is just to say that that the double bind of the intellectual is, on the one hand, that we know what travesties and catastrophes have been done in the name of the Enlightenment or in the name of things that we are attracted to, democracy, freedom. I mean, the rhetoric of democracy and freedom, in that name of that rhetoric, many nasty things have been done. Right? So that on the one hand, we are distrustful of those values. And on the other hand, I think there would be no intellectual work, no political work, without some reliance on those values. Now, this is not to say that the distrust ought to discount. I mean, well, I guess what I want to say is that if one questions those values, this isn't to eliminate them. It really means that what one ought to do is analyze what work gets done by these values, democracy, freedom, enlightenment, as they help produce history. And I think that the analysis of the work that these values produce, what they produce, is part of the work of the intellectual. And so I just wanted to close with this sort of double bind of the intellectual, and to say that intellectual work, I think, has to exist as a kind of negotiation among several kinds of conflicts and tensions. And I think that's why one of the great things about the film is that it shows Žižek to be one of the great analysts of the inevitability of political complicity. And I think that's something that ought to be the focus of much of our attention.
Maybe, yeah, thank you. I wonder whether Žižek is not at the cusp between two, at least a little from what you all said, two types of intellectuals. The traditional, let's say, 1950s to 1970s intellectual would be someone like Sartre, let's say, who is a figure, is a name, and is called upon to comment on various political, historical issues. So the fall of the Berlin Wall and so on. I mean, that was after his death, but all these, you expect a number of people like Noam Chomsky and so on to say something, the one-liner, the soundbite, and that will be provided by the intellectual. And there's also the totally different sense that I think Daniel called up, which is the almost anonymous intellectual who comes out of a cause, or like, etymologically speaking, as you may know, the French meaning was the born out of the Dreyfus affair, and apart from one name, Zola, we have forgotten more or less the names of the others. And I was thinking of a parallel, it's almost a sort of a philological parallel with the way ideology was also coined after les idéologues, philosophers who completely disappeared, but Napoleon hated them, and then he called them ideologue, ideology. And this is the term that Žižek, I think, works most competently with. And I see Žižek as a very smart critic of cultural ideologies or ideology today, but in the same way as intellectuals was used very negatively, derogatively, by Clemenceau, who hated this group around Zola, who believed that Dreyfus was innocent, and he was, and against the majority of, let's say, the right in France. And makes me think of one writer, like Blanchot, who was the opposite of the public intellectual. That is, he never allowed himself to be photographed, mm-hmm. although he was extremely political. But in one article, he discusses the Zola, the Dreyfus affair, and the difference between Zola and Paul Valéry, who didn't want to be an intellectual, who wanted to be a poet, and therefore ended up being against Dreyfus in this very sad moment in Paul Valéry's career. But I wonder, therefore, if this is this link between ideology and intellectuals, terms that were, you know, always from the start derogatory, but are absolutely necessary. Where would Žižek find his cause? Or does he have a cause? Is it just the Lacanian cause? I'm, of course, punning on la cause Freudienne, which is Lacan's, let's say, the last avatar of the Lacanian school. Is this something he believes in? Is Lacan enough to be a cause today? Or is he just somebody who reminds us that the fall of the Berlin Wall is a relatively recent occurrence, and that there is still, you know, the Soviet Union and all that world that we have to take into account? And would it just be a symptom and not a cause? That's a general question.
So I think that it comes back to the question that Eduardo has asked about the role of intellectual as having to do with that which is not voiced, or those who have not a voice. And it seems that there's a hesitation here between, on one hand, you could say that according to Žižek, the Lacanian approach is not voiced enough, and it could illuminate a number of realities. On the other hand, to defend this, correspond to defend a system as opposed to defending those who have no voice. And I think that regarding the second type of approach, which is to me closer to the definition of a full intellectual, it is very interesting to see, it seems to me, to look a little bit at historical variations, in that you have certain intellectuals who defend those who have no voices, but they defend certain groups that have no voices, and they become the intellectuals of one given group. And on the other hand, what was extraordinary about Sartre, and I know this because I was one of these people who went to solicit Sartre, please, Mr. Sartre, would you please intervene in favor of? And usually he said yes, astonishingly. He was available enough to say yes. So Sartre was somehow like almost a medium by himself. He put his rhetorical capacity in the name of a series of very successive and sometimes very different causes. And I think that it is interesting to see this sort of, what is the range of causes that you can espouse or not espouse.
Well, that seems to be something that Žižek looks at very critically, as you'll see in the film. He makes these very provocative statements. What do you say, that he's the last Stalinist, that he really likes Lenin. What else has he got? He's got that all people are evil, and that authoritarianism is underrated in various ways. And I think there's a sense in which he is playing a kind of deliberately provocative role. There's also a sense in which you could say, as Eduardo would, that he's giving voices to the voiceless. He's giving voice to opinions which are really prescribed. You're not supposed to say that. And that's not only charming, it's kind of valuable. Mm-hmm. But there is no sense, I think, in which you could really cast, and this is, I have to say, I think this is kind of admirable about Žižek. He will not allow himself to be appropriated as, mm-hmm. I am the voice of the voiceless.
Right.
I mean, the only voiceless guy he's speaking for is Stalin. Mm-hmm. And that's because he'd be dead. Mm-hmm. So that, I think that refusal to be cast as any kind of public intellectual in the sense of a sort of people's advocate, mm-hmm. is one of his most visible features, and the one that he's most committed to.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder whether he's not thinking that his reference to Lacan is not the last possible way to be a Marxist today. At least this is not necessarily what I think, but what he seems to convey. That is, in order to be a Marxist today, you need to take into account all the mechanisms by which late capitalism is creating, let's say, desire, enjoyment, and all the elements that, say, publicity knows very well how to work with, make us want to have a bigger car or a bigger house and so on all the time, how to produce, how to consume. I think this is his own, let's say, attack in today's society. Mm-hmm. So I think he's aware that traditional Marxism has perhaps met a certain limit, and Lacanian discourse tends to be a little too psychoanalytic and closed up in itself. So by blending the two, he has a sort of machine that is indeed endless and that can produce endless discourses. I don't know what it is.
I think that's right. I think there's something, I mean, it's quite that he's quite good on the subject of enjoyment. But there is something about Žižek as a public intellectual, now that, you know, when you speak about him, he doesn't want to talk to Time magazine. He's not really interested in that. He's interested in talking to you. And he recognizes that he really doesn't have to be accessible in the way that that's understood in America. In that really anti-intellectual way in which it's understood in America, he thinks he knows his audience, and he does not underrate it. He has in his willingness to make arguments from Lacan, from Marx, and to make them, quite frankly, without rendering them accessible, he really does recognize that there is a public audience for that, for him, which is not allowed to be visible, especially in America. That the fact that people might turn out in great numbers for a lecture of Žižek is something which American media tells us over and over again cannot happen. And yet, of course, it does. So that is rather a powerful gesture.
I see Ellen making gestures, and maybe we could open to the audience if you have questions. Yes, I see.
Public intellectual is the one who has a feeling, a social feeling. For that very reason, his sort of criticism of Noam Chomsky, that Noam Chomsky doesn't have feeling. That also distinguishes Žižek from the rest. But also related to the left spectrum is we have to understand that the attribution of the public intellectual to Žižek is precisely has to be grounded in where he comes from. This is the Slovenian, already a book has been written on this, that as he himself says, I come from the swamp of the ex-communism, who is challenging Western academia. This is the ground on which Žižek stands as a public intellectual. And an enormous insight that you said about the female here, both of you, and that's only one single thing that the filmmaker does not necessarily have to come with, which is social theory expertly set. And that, again, is enormous insight, and a good example is Chiorgos Tamim, the Iranian filmmaker, mm-hmm. that Godard said that the art of film has ended with the Taste of Cherry, by Chiorgos Tamim, and Chiorgos Tamim never comes to expertly say that, oh, I'm saying something about, you know, Iranian reaction. So I just wanted to hear this, that especially the difference between a European intellectual and...
Maybe, I think you have a strong point, but, and I know there are Slovenians in this room. When I went to Ljubljana, it felt much more like Paris, London, Milan, than anything we can associate with the Eastern Bloc. And so I think the swamp, yes, but up to a point. And maybe because it's such a tiny, tiny country, open to many languages, many cultures, it can play better that role, and also be there for have a greater impact in a great big country like the U.S. You see what I mean? Just to qualify a little bit this idea of the swamp of Europe, maybe. Other questions?
What strikes me here is that in Shoah you have an extremely unusual form of cinema enunciation. It's using really the rhetorics of cinema in order to somehow speak in a way which is totally unheard of. I mean, how is it that an interviewer dares aggress the interviewee? And I was thinking of what I heard. I mean, I have the enormous disadvantage in this panel of never having seen Zizek, nor heard him, nor read him. So I'm a bit confused by what he's saying. But what I'm very struck by is that the return to the, you know, giving the voice to the voiceless, offering a voice to the voiceless. And I think that what you seem to describe has a lot to do with his style of enunciation, that is a quirky enunciation. And I remember I was very astonished when I was told what is the meaning of the word interpretation in psychoanalysis. Interpretation in psychoanalysis does not consist in interpreting. Interpretation in psychoanalysis consists in saying something that very short, very briefly sometimes, or sometimes of saying nothing at all, of making a gesture. But this then triggers a certain form of reflexivity. And in a certain way, then you could say that what Zizek is trying to, the voice he's trying to bring out is the very voice of the public that is listening to him. In other terms, he's somehow provoking, or he's trying to provoke reflexive processes by doing something that is very close to the Lacanian or to the Freudian interpretation.
I mean, I think that there is a moment in the film that confirms that. I mean, because he actually says that in relation to his audience, he tries to imagine himself as the analyst, and that it's a question of transference and so on. But I think that to say that is also to qualify something that you said, Anne, very sort of quickly at one point, that he knows his audience. And I think there's a moment in the film where he actually says that they expect something from him. He stands for something, but he can't master or control whatever it is that they expect from him. I mean, there's a way in which he doesn't know the audience. And I think that this is very close to what you're saying, because I think that when we're asking this question of how is it that Zizek can become so popular and have a following, let's say, in the States, when in fact his texts are difficult, although the popular cultural references, the jokes and so on, are a way of making him somewhat accessible. I think that part of the question is linked to what is it that helps constitute a particular readership, right? And I think that this is, how does one select in advance and in relation to one's work what somebody might find in it? And I think that I never know to whom my work is addressed. And I think this is why Benjamin said that it's not fruitful to think about the receiver of a work or the receiver of a set of works. And I think this is because even though we can imagine certain elements of an audience and what they might tap into and what they might be interested in, it's impossible to ever know that that community exists in that way. Right? I think that's just not possible. And that for me, what compels me to write is actually not knowing the audience in a certain way. But I think that this still leaves this question of why it is that what is it that he's tapping into, or what is it that, and as he suggests, that it whatever their interest is in him reveals something about them, right, more than anything else, which gets back to the exact point.
Grappling with the problem of dirty hands, but at the same time not being able to advance this. I was thinking about the public intellectual as having aspects of, or being a fusion of, the politician, the entertainer, the academic, and the artist. Mm-hmm. And all of these roles, in some ways, usually when they're involved, they involve an evasion of political responsibility, or at least some sort of political obligation. And I was thinking in this context of Max Weber's two essays on politics and also science with the scholarship as a vocation, which is politics is all about the assumption of a certain kind of responsibility. And science or scholarship is assumption of a certain kind of responsibility. The problem is that out of either self-interest or in the name of some extraterrestrial ideal, politicians are always evading responsibility. And I'm wondering if in this context of being someone, one who provokes, one who's trying to create an ongoing debate, if in the public intellectual you could have someone who has political irresponsibility, but in a positive sense. If that's in some way what's constitutive about the public intellectual, is that precisely that they do not step into the role of being a full politician?
I mean, I think that's probably, there's a way in which he would like that, probably. I mean, but I think that the route would be something like this. I think that the intellectual, as he, he enacts it, as he stages it, because even though he goes after Lacan for a particular kind of style, he does. I agree with Anne that he has a style, which includes the humor, includes the references to popular culture, the Lacanianism, but which isn't just a bringing together of Marx, because he does say at one point that Lacan already has the Marx within him. Mm. I think that there's a way in which that style, if one calls it that, or even a multiple set of styles, is there as something that suspends safety zones, right? So that he suspends safety zones, he tries to exceed certain norms and practices and rules within what one would expect within a kind of academic setting or academic talk. He was a visitor at Princeton for a semester, and he gave a faculty seminar, and he talked about the virtues of adultery, so these sorts of things. And so I think it's partly, partly provocation and so on, but I think that irresponsibility to certain kinds of things is also a way of being responsible to other kinds of things, right? So that he's irresponsible to a certain set of norms and ideas in order to address something else. I mean, one can still analyze what he's doing by that, but I think that there would be a way, say, in a formal level, to think about what you're trying to talk about.
Yeah, maybe if I could add to this, which I think is a great way of presenting it, is the question of responsibility. The intellectual should be responsible and a little bit irresponsible as well, so as to have this unmoored, unattached questioning. It seems to me that one of the models that Lacan always mentions as the prototype of the psychoanalyst would be Socrates, the gadfly in the polis. Socrates, who poses questions, who says he doesn't know, and in fact he knows very well, or he knows where he wants to lead people. I think Žižek plays this role a little bit, and his way of being like Socrates, that is, parading his non-knowledge, is by saying, by contradicting himself, by taking the same joke and using it five times in different contexts, and then it's still a joke, but you don't really know what it explains. So this the recurrent gesture in Žižek, it's all very simple. Yeah. And then a year later, it's also very simple, but it's a completely different explanation. So the multiplication of these explanations makes them more like questions than like answers.
I mean, it's a quick addition to that also. It's just that, I mean, if you think of just the way in which somebody would talk about ethics, right? I mean, we usually think about ethics as a set of standards and for behavior and so on. I think Zizek would probably say something like, the moment you have a standard, the moment you have a set of rules for behavior and so on, it's impossible to have an ethics. Right? So that part of the provocation has to do with that excess that he's trying to stage at every moment, I think.
I was just very struck by somehow the processual quality of his interventions, mm-hmm. in that it's an open process where mm-hmm. he seems to put a number of things into question. And I was just wondering, you know, whether from the point of view of history, or history of literature, or history of forms, this is not very similar, but in the intellectual world, to the adventure of surrealism in literature or in art, where you have the same combination of references to psychoanalysis, references mm-hmm. to the adventures, desire of revolution, etc., except that the discourse is situated in quite another field. So it is very interesting, it seems to me, to suggest that there is perhaps some continuity or some resurgence of surrealism under a new form.
Absolutely, because he has mm-hmm. does lots of the surrealist gestures, yeah. lots yeah. of the sort of the use of the banal, the preoccupation with the perverse, the mm-hmm. certain sort of provocative character, the juxtapositions that don't seem to belong, mm-hmm. and the curious physicality of his account. I mean, not just sort of in what he says, but in how he says it. Mm-hmm. Sort of, it. I think there is a sense. It would be quite interesting to think of him as a surrealist. Mm-hmm.
One more question, one last question, I think. Okay, two more.
I think a lot of the comments that have been raised so far seem to be addressing this whole issue of when a person decides for themselves and kind of lets me know that they are now interested in or are an intellectual, most of us being an artist so far.
I think you're right, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, my comment is really related to that, at least as I see it, and that is I'm concerned about this question of the intellectuals who give voice to the voiceless, because it seems to me that if, in fact, Zizek is saying that the problem of a public intellectual, condition of a public intellectual, is that the audience projects on the intellectual in ways that he can't control, seems to me that the notion of giving voice to the voiceless is to project upon people that are, in a sense, not able to argue with the intellectual what their voice is. And that seems to be a very ethically difficult notion, and it speaks to what concerns me about the arrogance of a kind of self-assigned political role.
You find him arrogant? Well,
I'm not talking about him. I'm talking about intellectuals in general and the sort of responsibility without further examination that somehow to speak for the voiceless is a good thing, as though when we speak for the voiceless are by definition those people who aren't answering back. And there's a kind of arrogance in that I think is very troubling.
Yeah, I think he is in some ways the opposite of that. I mean, remember, this is the man who likes solace. And he doesn't just like Stalin. He really likes Stalin in some important and interesting ways. I mean, he likes order and authority. And he says over and over again, oh, people are evil. I'm a monster. And there, I think he means that. I think when he is often most revelatory when he's being funny. And funny and provocative. But he's not. He seems to utterly eschew the project of distributive justice, speaking for the voiceless. As far as I can tell, he has no interest whatsoever in that. It is much more the surrealist project, I think.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, still, we should not, and we'll see this in the film, he almost got elected president of his country. So that's this element.
I thought it was the fifth out of four.
Well, no, I think he did better than that. And it was, I think, third or something like that. And could have, at least. That not so many intellectuals even saw, I think, was never a candidate for the presidency in France. So, I think one thing it does is to force us question the role of the intellectual and the constitution of the public. And I think if we are a public, it's also because maybe we feel we are called upon to be a public because of his presence, of the questions he poses. Anyway, I think we should stop here, and we'll be able to continue discussing with the filmmaker afterwards. So we'll watch the film, which is only 17 minutes, and then we'll continue discussing afterwards.